Hello, seafood friends. You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent, bringing you everything from the boats to the boardrooms, breaking down the news, spilling a little industry fish oil, and sharing the sharp market insights you need to know. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. In our top story this week, U.S. shrimp imports have continued to decline even after the removal of President Donald Trump's higher tariffs. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has updated its seafood trade data, which shows that the U.S. imported nearly 57,000 metric tons of shrimp worth $482 million in March of 2026, 19% less volume and 16% less value than in March of 2025. Undercurrent America's editor Jason Huffman reported that it was the eighth consecutive month in which the U.S. imported less shrimp year on year, and this is in spite of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on February 20th that found Trump's use of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to be illegal.
In other shrimp news, Sanga, Ecuador's second largest shrimp exporter, has been removed from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration Red List, where it had been placed over concerns about salmonella contamination. The company's shrimp was flagged by FDA in Import Alert 1681 on February 6th of this year, placing it on the regulatory list that allows imported products to be detained at U.S. borders without physical examination. Sanga's addition to the U.S. Red List created a supply gap, which UCN price analyst Gary Morrison told us led to longer lead times and increased competition for other available inventory. However, the company's name no longer appears on the alert, which was last updated on April 21st. And for a product or firm to be removed from the list, the FDA states that there must be evidence that the conditions that led to it being listed has been resolved and that future shipments of the product will be safe and compliant. So a petition for removal from the red list, including all evidence, must then be submitted to FDA. And only then, if the criteria is met, will the FDA send a letter to the firm alerting it of the removal. So we've got a link to the story in the show notes.
Meanwhile, I've got some exciting news to share for our users of Undercurrent's Global Shrimp Tracker. Undercurrent added to its shrimp indices. Subscribers can view cyclical and long-term trends with full data and methodology built in. You can also measure performance against a basket of similarly traded items and protect yourself against sudden price shocks by tying contracts to a recognized index. The shrimp indices utilize a robust methodology that aggregate verified trade data, offering a level of transparency that was previously difficult to access. Check it out today.
Moving on to lobster. The White House Office of Management and Budget has thrown its support behind a bill introduced by U.S. Representative Jared Golden, a Maine Democrat, to extend the delay on requirements to amend rules related to roped lobster and Jonah crab traps in order to better protect North Atlantic right whales from entanglement. Now, the Office of Management and Budget said that the administration strongly supports passage of H.R. 8509, which would extend the time period from 2028 until 2035, for which the Department of Commerce's National Marine Fisheries Service's final rule amending the regulations implementing the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan is deemed sufficient to ensure the continued authorizations of the American lobster and Jonah crab fisheries to make sure they're in full compliance with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The statement from the office also said that Golden's bill aligns with the executive order restoring American seafood competitiveness to promote the adoption of new technology and productive harvest of our seafood resources. And if the bill were presented to the president, his advisors would recommend that he sign it into law.
Right whales are critically endangered, with NOAA estimating approximately 380 individuals remaining, including just 70 reproductively active females. NOAA has declared an unusual mortality event for the species annually since 2017, when 35 right whale deaths were documented in Canadian and U.S. waters, prompting the call for regulatory changes.
But Golden and lobster industry stakeholders argue that existing and proposed rules risk undermining the state's lobster fishery, which landed 78.8 million pounds, valued at $461.4 million in 2025. Golden introduced H.R. 8509 on April 27th. It was referred to the House Committee on Natural Resources on the same day it was introduced.
All right, let's move along to scallops. Framework 40 continues to loom over the market and reinforce the idea that large count scallops are probably going to stay tight for a while. Though we are starting to see some selective downward pressure in smaller and mid-sized categories, especially the 10 to 20s and 20 to 30s. That lines up pretty well with what's happening at the dock at the New Bedford auction, where the catch mix continues to skew heavily towards smaller sizes. 10-20s and 20 to 30s made up almost the entire catch, while U10s and U12s combined were only about 2% of the volume. So even though there's product coming ashore, there's very little true large count supply entering the market. And that's where Framework 40 becomes important. The new framework eliminated access area trips and shifted the fleet entirely into open bottom fishing with 36 days at sea. The expectation from both NOAA and industry participants is that this season will produce even fewer scallops overall, and more importantly, fewer larger scallops. So the industry is expecting another year dominated by smaller meats, with U8s, 10s, and 12s becoming increasingly difficult to source. And that's a major reason why large count prices continue to hold firm despite softer dock prices in smaller categories. So what we're seeing right now is a really widening divide in the market. 2030s continue to face pressure because there's simply more of them available, while premium large count remains tight with very limited carryover inventory from last season. So on the imported side, Canada continues to provide very little relief. Normally, Canada would help ease some of the pressure in the premium segment, but that just hasn't happened this year. Japan actually moved higher again this week. Supply remains tight there, especially in larger sizes as well. And procurement costs are elevated and import volumes into the U.S. remain well below prior year levels. So Japanese scallops continue to command a premium and reinforce the firm tone at the top end of the market. Now, China remains relatively stable and continues to act as more of a value-oriented option, particularly in smaller sizes, while Peru is mostly unchanged with supply concentrated in smaller counts again, like 40-50s and 50-60s. So the overall takeaway right now is that the market still feels very split. Smaller scallops are seeing softer conditions tied to landing composition, but large count scallops continue to be supported by what increasingly looks like a longer term supply issue under Framework 40.
Thanks, Lauren. Now shifting over to pollock, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced this week that it's seeking to purchase a variety of frozen Alaska pollock products for use in domestic food distribution programs. Per the 12-page solicitation published Monday on May 4th, USDA is seeking to purchase a combined total of more than 2.3 million pounds of Alaska pollock. So the solicitation is broken down to 380,000 pounds of frozen fillets, 342,000 pounds of frozen sticks, 554,400 pounds of frozen bulk cartons, and over a million pounds of frozen breaded sticks. So USDA, on top of that, is also seeking 1,800 pounds of 22-pound packages of frozen haddock fillets.
And that's not the only big pollock news. Joining us now on the pod is Undercurrent reporter Jacob Resnick to talk about how Alaska's big pollock harvesters are disputing claims made by a Republican gubernatorial candidate in the U.S. state that they have dodged landing taxes by directly transshipping whitefish to Asian markets.
So it's an election year in Alaska, and it's a really crowded field of potential candidates. And the reason that this is important in the fish world is the Alaska governor has outsized influence in nominating members of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. And that's a federal body that really sets all the allocations and manages for the Bering Sea, Gulf of Alaska, pollock, crab, what have you. So this state race is really important in the global fish world. It's a crowded field, and candidates have been saying lots of things to get attention. Interestingly, one of the things we wrote about this back in February, the controversies about trawl bycatch has become a mainstream issue in this state race. And so a lot of the hopefuls have been falling over themselves, trying to prove that they are the candidate that would, you know, get tough, take a hard look at fishery management practices in federal fisheries. And the background of this, of course, is the salmon collapse in Western Alaska, which is really important for subsistence needs in really rural communities. Now, of course, it's controversial how much the trawl fleet is responsible for the salmon collapse. Even its biggest critics aren't blaming it all on the trawl fleet, but it is one of the few, arguably one of the few levers that humans can pull to try to mitigate some of these challenges. So all that being said, one of the hopefuls, a former Anchorage mayor, the largest city in Alaska, so he's a household name, Dave Bronson, put out this statement on the first of the month, and he'd claimed that his team had basically done its own investigation and found a pattern that's like tax evasion conspiracy, that the trawl fleet when it was catching pollock at sea, was transshipping on foreign flag vessels directly to Asia without paying the state landing taxes. And these state landing taxes are really, really important to coastal communities, like in Dutch Harbor, et cetera, for funding the infrastructure. Now, immediately, the industry responded the same day on social media saying they didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know what he was talking about. They pointed out that the federal laws are very, very explicit about, you know, whether your fish is caught at sea or landed in a port, the landing taxes are assessed and that they pay all their taxes. And, you know, and if you were caught evading these taxes, there are really, really stark penalties in the American Fisheries Act. So Undercurrent, of course, we went a little further because in this long statement, Bronson had claimed that he had turned evidence over to the federal authorities, and that'd be U.S. Coast Guard and NOAA Office of Law Enforcement, who has the oversight role on the fisheries. And we heard back from Coast Guard. First of all, interestingly, they said that they hadn't gotten any referrals from the Bronson campaign.
Oh.
They also said that they bought. Yeah, exactly. Show receipts. I mean, if this were true, this would be a huge story, right? And so, you know, we didn't just look at all like he said, she said. You know, we wanted to see, you know, what's happened. And that was the first kind of red flag on their claim. They also went further and said, you know, that they monitor this stuff really closely, and they've found, and I'm quoting here from their statement, they've not found any evidence of cargo vessels illegally operating in Alaska's waters. So we tried really hard to get the Bronson campaign to engage. 2 days after the story, I heard back from a campaign manager saying, like, what can we do for you? I sent him the story, trying to get comment. We haven't heard anything either directly or on social media. So it's kind of died away, but it just shows, I think, the extent that political candidates are willing to take to try to get attention in this race. And, you know, these kind of what had been really niche, interesting, or like little fishery issues have like spilled over into the mainstream in the U.S. state of Alaska. So that I you know, if people are interested, I encourage them to read our reporting on this, and we'll continue to follow it as it develops.
Thanks, Jacob.
Now, before we go, we didn't talk about anything delicious yet.
It was all down to business this week, but still time for some fun news. Cousins Maine Lobster co-founders and real-life cousins, Jim Slikas and Sabin Lobeck, found success with their food truck on Shark Tank and currently have over 85 units, including both food trucks and brick-and-mortar restaurants. Well, they've now launched a new concept. Say hello to Cousins Fried Seafood.
Find me the nearest one. So what are we serving instead of lobster here?
So actually, they still have lobster. They are offering a split Maine lobster tail, obviously fried, but they also have haddock, scallop, shrimp, and whole belly Maine clams. So, and everything, this is, you and I have been to, have you and I been to a Cousins?
Yes, we have. It was documented. Yes.
Yes. We went to the food truck. I went to a brick and mortar location with somebody else. I cheated on you.
Yes, you do. I remember that. You went to like the opening.
Yes. And I met Sabin and I met Jim, and Barbara.
Yes.
From Shark Tank. Yep. Yeah. So, that was a really cool experience, but I love their food. But when you go there, it's, everything's like a la carte. So you get just your lobster roll. And then if you want French fries, you have to obviously order that separately, but everything is served as a platter at this new concept. So you get fries and coleslaw.
So what are the prices that we're talking here? Because I think the base price for a lobster roll at the food truck was like around $25.
Yeah, they range. So the fried seafood concept, you can get shrimp or chicken for $15. They have haddock for $19. So right there, you have a couple options under $20, which I don't think you really have too much of at the original lobster roll truck. And then it jumps, you can, you know, up to $30 for scallops, $35 for the split Maine lobster tail or the whole belly Maine clams. But again, you're getting a platter, so more of a value.
Now, the timing of this launch is actually really interesting. Of course, it's a way for them to expand, but you can't help but think about the cost of lobster meat right now for a company that really relies on it.
Yeah. Jason Huffman reported the other week, and I think he was on even a couple of weeks ago talking about it, about how food service operators are struggling with margins due to the high costs. He talked to Daniel Beck, the owner of Mason's Famous Lobster. It's a Maryland-based restaurant chain with 35 brick-and-mortar locations, who explained that they need the wholesale cost to be about $30 or less per pound so they can keep offering their sandwiches at the going rate of $20 to $24 each. And I was just looking at the prices on Undercurrents, and I think it was at $34.25. That's
yikes.
Yeah. But then again, Mason's Famous Lobster just opened its first food truck. So the company said that the truck starting on Delaware's Eastern Shore doubles as a moving billboard. So it's like building brand awareness and franchise development.
I love it. Well, that does it for us this week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week. Bye-bye.